Judges chapter 9, beginning in verse 22, reading to the end of the chapter. Judges chapter 9, beginning in verse 22, a crushing end. Judges 9, verse 22, you've been standing for a while. If you are able, please stand again in honor of reading the Word of God. Judges 9, beginning in verse 22. Abimelech ruled over Israel 3 years. And God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the leaders of Shechem, and the leaders of Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech, that the violence done to the 70 sons of Jerubbabel might come, and their blood be laid on Abimelech, their brother, who killed them, and on the men of Shechem, who strengthened his hands to kill his brothers. And the leaders of Shechem put men in ambush against him on the mountaintops, and they robbed all who passed by them along the way. And it was told to Abimelech. And Gaal, the son of Abed, moved into Shechem with his relatives, and the leaders of Shechem put confidence in him. And they went out into their fields and gathered grapes from their vineyards and trod them and held a festival. And they went into the house of their god and ate and drank and reviled Abimelech. And Gaal, the son of Abed, said, "Who is Abimelech? Who are we of Shechem that we should serve him? Is he not the son of Jerubbabel? And is not Zebul his officer? Serve the men of Hamor, the father of Shechem. But why should we serve him? Would that this people were under my hand. Then I would remove Abimelech, and I would say to Abimelech, increase your army and come out." And when Zebul, the ruler of the city, heard the words of Gaal, the son of Abed, his anger was kindled. And he sent messengers to Abimelech secretly, saying, "Behold, Gaal is the son of Abed, and his relatives have come to Shechem, and they are stirring up the city against you. Now, therefore, go by night, you and the people who are with you, and set an ambush in the field. Then in the morning, as soon as the sun is up, rise early and rush upon the city. And when he and the people who are with him come out against you, you may do to them as your hand finds to do." So Abimelech and all the men who were with him rose up by night and set an ambush against Shechem in four companies. And Gaal, the son of Abed, went out and stood at the entrance of the gate of the city. And Abimelech and the people who were with him rose from the ambush. And when Gaal saw all the people, he said to Zebul, "Look, people are coming down from the mountaintops." Zebul said to him, "You mistake the shadow of the mountains from men." And Gaal spoke again and said, "Look, people are coming down from the center of the land. One company is coming from the direction of the divine oak." And then Zebul said to him, "Where is your mouth now, you who said, 'Who is Abimelech that we should serve him?' Are not these the people whom you despise? Go out now and fight with them." And Gaal went out at the head of the leaders of Shechem and fought with Abimelech. And Abimelech chased him, and he fled before him, and many fell wounded up to the entrance of the gate. And Abimelech lived in Aramah, and Zebul drove out Gaal and his relatives so that they could not dwell at Shechem. On the following day, the people went out into the field, and Abimelech was told. He took his people and divided them into three companies and set an ambush in the fields. And he looked and saw the people coming out of the city, and he rose against them and killed them. Abimelech and the company that was with him rushed forward and stood at the entrance of the gate of the city, while the two companies rushed all who were with them in the field and killed them. And Abimelech fought against the city all that day, and he captured the city and killed the people who were in it, and he razed the city and sowed it with salt. And when all the leaders of the tower of Shechem heard of it, they entered the stronghold of the house of El-Berith. And Abimelech was told that all the leaders of the tower and all the people who were with them, or all the people of Shechem, were gathered together. And Abimelech went up to Mount Zalmon and all the people who were with him. And he took an axe in his hand and cut down the bundle of brushwood and took it up and laid it on his shoulder. And he said to the men who were with him, "What you have seen me do, you also do as I have done." So every one of the people cut down his bundle following Abimelech and put it against the stronghold. And they set the stronghold on fire over them so that all the people of the tower of Shechem also died. This was about 1,000 men and women. And then Abimelech went to Thebez and encamped against Thebez and captured it. But there was a strong tower within the city, and all the men and women and all the leaders of the city fled to it and shut themselves in it. And they went up to the roof of the tower. And Abimelech came to the tower and fought against it and drew near to the door of the tower to burn it with fire. And a certain woman threw an upper millstone on Abimelech's head and crushed his skull. And then he called quickly to the young man, his arm bearer, and he said to him, "Draw your sword and kill me, lest they say of me, 'A woman killed me.'" And his young man thrust him through, and he died. And when the men of Israel saw that Abimelech was dead, everyone departed to his home. And thus God returned the evil of Abimelech, which he committed against his father in killing his 70 brothers. And God also made all the evil of the men of Shechem return on their heads. And upon them came the curse of Jotham, the son of Jerubbaal. This is the word of the Lord. You may be seated. I want you to note that it is intentional. Intentional by the author that we only have limited mentioning or references to God in this passage. Two times. The first thing I want you to note is that within these limited references to God, the author uses the generic title Elohim instead of the more intimate Hebrew title Yahweh. Scholars debate that this shows multiple authorship of Judges because there seems to be a changing of the title for God, but it is used throughout. This changing occurs throughout this book. And other scholars believe, and I am in agreement, that this reflects the general attitude of the people and how they have forgotten their God. That there is no longer a reference to the Hebrew God, Yahweh, the God who makes covenant with His people and redeems His people, the strong one of Israel, but now it is the more generic title that not only the Hebrew people are using, but even the pagan people would use to recognize deity, Elohim. So they have forgotten their God, as we have read in 8:34, and they went after Baal-berith, and they did not deal kindly with Gideon and his family. So we have these two references to God using the Hebrew word Elohim instead of Yahweh. But I also want you to note that these two references to God are highly significant to our interpreting this passage. What we must draw from this passage. You'll note that the references to God, the two, are at the beginning of the passage and at the end. Kind of serving as the brackets. Or, as we would say, if some of you are hungry, the layers of bread to a sandwich. As the outer or layers of bread hold together the meat. And so here we have the outer layers of bread serving from the references to God, verses 23 and 24 and verses 56 and 57, as the author references God, these are the outer layers that hold the meat of the story together. This is the significant portion, how we draw implication and application from what is going on. So he reveals the general attitude of the people by slipping in a couple of references of God using Elohim. But these two references are highly significant in that it is showing the reader who is actually in control of what's going on. These references are strategically placed in the passage to show that God here is orchestrating and organizing men's affairs. While the involvement of God does not consume much space, as we see in the previous stories of the Judges, the quick references to God here are mandatory for you, the reader, to mark. While the people of Israel have forgotten their God, the reader is certainly not to do so. So quick references to God, but highly significant for what we must draw from this passage. Now, the cycle or sequence of events has not followed the pattern of the previous situations. What is the general pattern of Judges? Israel commits apostasy, falling away from their God, going after false gods. And then God summons an oppressor to come and persecute His people so that they would cry out for deliverance. And upon their crying out for deliverance, God would come as the deliverer to raise up a judge and bring victory and rest for Israel. Now while we see that the cycle here changes, the roles that God plays do not change. Even within the limited way in which God is referenced, these two quick mentionings of God in the passage, the roles He plays are still clearly revealed. You ask, well, what specifically are the roles that He plays in the book of Judges? Well, specifically, there are two of them. That you will see that throughout Judges, and particularly in this passage, God serves as both judge of His people and deliverer of His people. He rains down judgment upon them, and He delivers them from that judgment. So judge and deliver. And so the disruption of the cycle, apostasy, oppressor, raising up a judge, deliverance and rest. Though the cycle has been disrupted, we don't see the usual pattern here. I believe that this disruption allows the reader to see God serving in both these rows more clearly. Let's review. Remember that God has raised up not trouble from an outside source, but from within Israel. Previously, he has summoned a foreign oppressor, Moab, Canaan, Midian, to persecute his people. But now trouble from within. Why? Israel's apostasy has reached greater depths of depravity. Already we have noted the syncretic religion. What's that mean? The mixing of religion. The fertility gods and the God of the Hebrews. Israel is recognizing or has been recognizing and honoring both in a distorted way. However, now their depravity has reached greater depths. Instead of acknowledging both the Hebrew God and the fertility gods, it seems now that Israel has displaced Yahweh, their God, the Hebrew God, with Baal. Seemingly completely. How do we note that? Well, previously, Yahweh has been acknowledged as the God who made covenant with Israel. Going all the way back to Father Abraham. He made a covenant with him that he would bring from Abraham a people to himself, as numerous as the stars of the heavens and the sands of the seashore, and he would give him a land of promise. And there would be a covenant with Israel through Moses that he would be their God as they would be his people. As they would abide by his word, he would bless them. And if they disobeyed his word, he would curse them. So throughout the Old Testament, Yahweh is the God of the covenant. And Israel has to recognize this to be so, and how God proved himself faithful to that covenant time and time again throughout their history. However, Israel is now acknowledging Baal as the God of the covenant. You go back and read how they're worshiping Baal Berith. Berith is the Hebrew word translated into the English covenant. You put Baal Berith in English, it means Lord of the covenant. So now they have displaced Yahweh, the God of covenant, now with Baal, Lord of the covenant. And for this, God has brought disaster upon his people. But not from a foreign oppressor, now from within. As he raises up one of their own, Abimelech, a Hebrew, a son of Gideon, to oppress Hebrews. Abimelech, the son of Gideon, from his concubine, from Shechem. We have read that Abimelech raises support from his mother's people as he goes back to Shechem. And he calls upon them to support him. And they use financial support to hire thuggish mercenaries to aid Abimelech in the slaughter of his 70 brothers living in Ophrah. Those 70 brothers, sons of Gideon from Hebrew women. So instead of treating the household of Gideon with respect and honor, Abimelech leads a clan of assassins to kill, as we read, 69 of the 70 sons. The youngest, Jotham, escapes. And he hid while the capture and murders took place. Abimelech took the 69 men and marched them to the stone of sacrifice one by one, slaughtering them. When Jotham hears of Abimelech's treachery, that he had even been aided by the Shechemites' people, Jotham comes out of hiding, and we read that he ascends to a portion of Mount Gerizim. And there, an acoustically advantageous spot cries out before the city and the city's officials, and he addresses them, remember, with a prophetic fable. Long story short, the fable announced that both king and people will turn on one another and destroy one another. As Abimelech is the bramble, with fire would come out with him and destroy the cedars of Lebanon, the Shechemites. And the Shechemites, the cedars of Lebanon, fire would proceed from them and destroy Abimelech, the bramble. And so as we read in this portion, verses 22 through 57, God is bringing that prophecy to pass. He has brought judgment upon the people for their crimes. Now here is what is crucial for today's understanding of this entire episode of Abimelech. That God remains most glorious. He is in sovereign control over every aspect of his people's salvation and even their judgment. The judgment over all humanity. And note what is so interesting. As God is responsible for the judgment upon the people, He is also responsible for the people's deliverance. Now you may ask, it is very clear that He brings judgment upon the people, but how does He serve as deliverer of His people in this passage? I don't necessarily see that as clearly as I do the judgment. Well, while Abimelech would be the agent God uses to carry out judgment on the people of the land, note that God would then intervene and limit the scope of that judgment. His judgment, as we will see, serves as recompense to return upon the head of Abimelech and the Shechemites for the evil they have committed. At the same time, Israel is suffering because of Abimelech's actions. But God serves as deliverer, as He would not allow that destruction of Abimelech to go unrestrained. He will only carry out what God would deem sufficient to recompense the people for their wicked actions. So God uses Abimelech as He unleashes judgment upon the people. And then God would deliver the people from His own judgment as He would sovereignly intervene to bring an end to Abimelech's havoc. As I was preparing this message, I just kept hearing Jeremiah's words in Lamentations. From whence do both good and bad come? From the mouth of the Lord. So the ultimate point of the passage, He is the sovereign God of the universe who here serves as both deliverer and judge of humanity. This is the major theme of Judges, the glory of God, and it is seen here as He serves these two roles. So as we go to the text, we look at what I have entitled the beginning of the end for Abimelech and the Shechemites. Verses 22 through 25, the narrator records for us the duration and scope of Abimelech's reign. We've already read of his treachery and his rise to power as he sought to become king not only of the Shechemites, but of the entire land. And it seems that he somewhat reaches that goal. Since his rise to power, the jurisdiction of Abimelech's reign has expanded beyond the walls of Shechem and now to Israel. You read in verse 22, and Abimelech ruled over Israel 3 years. It seems that he rules over the whole land of Israel. However, Israel here may not necessarily mean the entire nation. Perhaps it's restricted to a local region, which would have represented the country as a whole. And then the author tells us that his rule over Israel lasted 3 years. The author gives us the first of his two references to God's intervention. As he said earlier, the reference to God is from, or as we said earlier, the first reference to God is Elohim, the generic reference to God, rather than the more intimate title Yahweh. One of the ways in which the author is showing the spiritual descent of Israel. And he tells us that God, notice this, sent an evil spirit between Shechem and Abimelech. God sends an evil spirit to disrupt the unity between city and king. This teaches us something theologically. As God is ruler over all realms, both spiritual dimensions as well as the physical universe, He rules heaven and earth. All that is above, all that is below, all thrones, all powers, all principalities, all dominions, the forces of darkness are under His absolute sway. Satan himself is even on a leash. He is a pawn in the divine scheme. All things, all beings are subject to His sovereign command. And here He unleashes an evil spirit to begin the disruption prophesied by Jotham's fable, that the bramble would come against the cedars of Lebanon, and the cedars of Lebanon would come against the bramble. The spirit that God sends dissolves the loyalty of the king's subjects. The verb here used to describe what is happening literally can read to break faith or to deal treacherously. So they begin to conspire against Abimelech, the citizens of Shechem. That evil spirit is sent for a twofold purpose. First, to break ties between subjects and king, but also to punish both the Shechemites and Abimelech for the treachery committed against the household of Gideon, the Lord's servant. We note the first way the Shechemites show that their loyalty to Abimelech has dissolved is that we read that the officials of Shechem adopt a strategy of posting robbers at the mountaintops on major routes in and out of the city. There these robbers would serve to ambush those who passed by, coming in and out of the city. This would serve, listen, to both empty Abimelech's pockets as well as hitting his pride. It would be viewed that the king, the ruler, is powerless, really, to provide security and safety of travel throughout the region. So it hits his pocketbook, and it's a slam on his ability to protect the people as king. And for this inability, it would be perceived as, why would citizens loyally support the upkeep of his rule? He can't provide safety of passage, even to the city of Shechem. Additionally, it seems that Abimelech, we read, does not even respond to the situation. Word is sent to him about what's going on, and he doesn't even respond. It seems that he could care less. It is only when his rule is directly challenged that he would leave his post and come and address the threat. But when citizens, or while citizens are being harassed and robbed by thievish thugs, he does not step up to provide protection and keep the peace. Again, another signal of Abimelech's self-absorbed rule. The second way the Shechemites show their loyalty to Abimelech is dissolving is through their support of a new character on the scene. A new character, a new political promise, who says that he would provide better circumstances if he were permitted to rule. The individual's name is Gaal. This means, if we translate it into English, to loathe. Some argue that this is a nickname rather than the official name, but it seems to be the official name because he is identified as Gaal, the son of Abed. And this conspiracy begins as they would go into the fields to gather grapes for the wine press, that they would call a festival, a fertility festival, in tribute to their gods. And so then they would go into their temple and they held a drunken feast in celebration of their gods, and there they began to curse Abimelech. Gaal follows the pattern of Abimelech's rise to power as we read him using some slick talk to win the loyalty of the people. He too plays the blood card. You remember Abimelech as he goes to his mother's people. I am of your bone. I am of your flesh. You would not have the 70 sons of Gideon, the Hebrew, to rule over you. While I am a son of Gideon, my mother is a Shechemite. Would you not want to have me as your ruler? And here comes Gaal playing the blood card as well. Verse 28, he indicates that he is a true native, that he is a true Shechemite. Abimelech's mother was a Shechemite. His father was a Hebrew. So Abimelech appealed to his mother's heritage to win the loyalty of the natives. Gaal states that he is a true Shechemite. Notice the pronoun we indicates his true relationship, or his relationship with the people. He refers to the people of Shechem as the sons of Hamor. If you go back and read Genesis 33 verse 19, Hamor is the founder of Shechem. So here is Gaal's appeal. How ridiculous is it for us to cower to this outsider, this son Jerubbabel, and also to his deputy, his pawn, his puppet on a string, Zebul. So he says, be true to your father Hamor. Be true to true Shechemite identity. Saying indirectly, my father a Shechemite, my mother a Shechemite. I am true Shechemite. And with this, he says, if only you were under my command, then I would get rid of this Abimelech, and I would say to him, call out your whole army. All along the while, we should be saying, what a gullible people. They easily gave their loyalty to Abimelech, and now they so easily and quickly relinquish it to give it to Gaal. In their temple, during their festival, Shechemite pride is stirred. Who is this Abimelech but the son of a Hebrew? They have different gods. They have different ways. So Gaal sets himself up as the upholder of the ancient faith, the old ways. We could say a conservative appeal. Let's go back and be loyal to our roots. And he wins the hearts of many of the people, particularly the officials of Shechem. And then we come to verse 33 as Jotham's fable begins to be fulfilled. Perhaps Zebul's actions, who's the ruler, the governor of the city appointed by Abimelech. We would think that he is loyal to Abimelech, but is he really? It seems that his loyalty to Abimelech was motivated by his own personal pride. Gaal, in his drunken gloating, calls out Zebul, you remember? He's Abimelech's pawn, this ruler of the city. He's a puppet on a string, in other words. And so Gaal calls Zebul out as one of Abimelech's cronies. And for this, Zebul maintains loyalty to Abimelech, in reality, to get back at the words of Gaal. Zebul, no doubt, had enjoyed privileges of being allowed and appointed to serve as governor under Abimelech's rule, which also contributed to his support. This fine living I've received by the hand of Abimelech, why would I turn against him? People were left to the side. After Zebul hears Gaal's drunken gloating, he sends word to Abimelech. Abimelech receives intelligence, information. And not only does he tell Abimelech that he stirs the people, that Gaal stirs the people against him, but he gives Abimelech a strategy. The strategy advised for Abimelech and his troops to descend from the mountains, the hills, under the cover of night, into the fields that outlaid the city. There they would lie in waiting until morning, and they would rise and destroy Gaal and his men. And we read, as they descend from the hilltops, Gaal is apparently sober enough to notice movement. He sees something what looked like troops coming down from the hillside. However, Zebul, who is pretending loyalty to Gaal, tells him, hey, your eyes are failing you. You just see the shadows of the mountains. However, it's becoming too evident. Troops continue to deploy, moving down the mountain for attack. And then Gaal says, as he looks to the center of the region, which is marked by the soothsayer's tree, or some texts say the diviner's oak. It is a place, a religious site, right there in the middle of the region that all eyes could see. And he notices movement around the sacred oak in the navel or the center of the land. And by this time, it's too late. It's too late to adequately mobilize his troops in for the defense. So as he sits, they become sitting ducks. Zebul then mocks Gaal with sadistic delight. He says, where is your big talk now? You who said, who is Abimelech that we should be subject to him? Aren't these the men you ridiculed? Now go and fight them. Gaal attempts to quickly muster his troops to defend himself as he leads his troops and the officials of the city, arming themselves for battle to go out and meet Abimelech. And we read that Abimelech routs them, all the way back to the city gate, leaving them wounded in the fields. And then he returns to Aramah, his headquarters. The dust settles. A new day arrives. And the people of Shechem now think, well, that skirmish is done. All is well. They go back to work. Gaal and the lords of Shechem seem to be out of the picture. They're removed. And for many, though they are disappointed that there would be no change in leadership, they simply try to find contentment to remain under Abimelech's rule. So the common folk return to the normal patterns of everyday life. They enter the fields to resume labor. But the man who had earlier victimized his own family members would now turn his rage on all the inhabitants of Shechem, even those innocent of the attempted insurrection. And when Abimelech heard that the people were leaving the city for work, he divided his forces into three companies, and then he began to set ambushes for the unsuspecting residents of the town. And once they were out in the fields, Abimelech made his move against them, and he struck those who approached the place where his own company was hiding. And then the other two companies did the same, and they slaughtered the people. Then came the rest of the city, taking up positions outside the city gate. We read that perhaps he must have overpowered the guards in the gateway. For the narrator reports that after fighting all day, they captured the city, slaughtered its inhabitants, and then they razed the city to the ground by sowing salt. What does that mean? This sequence of actions against conquered sites seems to be typical in the ancient Near Eastern, of ancient Near Eastern victors, kings. The significance of spreading salt, as I read, is a bit uncertain. Some suggested it was to render the ground infertile. But spreading salt over every square inch of all the real estate would have taken an extraordinary amount of salt and an incredible amount of time. Likely, most likely, this was a symbolic act of pronouncing a curse upon the land for the future, and also served as a gloat of the conquering victor, that he curses the city. While the mass slaughter and destruction was taking place, we find that there was a remnant that escaped from the city and ran to the defensive stronghold called the Tower or Citadel of Shechem. Some argue that it was actually outside the city. When cities were overtaken, they had a place to flee to hold up. Whether it was in or outside the city, it was a place that they went to hide. It was called the Temple of El Berith, the city or the citadel of Shechem. Baal Berith or El Berith. This place served as a defensive stronghold where the people were held up in the attack. Many residents of the city had fled to escape Abimelech. Abimelech went into Mount Zalmon as he noticed the people fled to the citadel. And he goes to Mount Zalmon, and there he cuts off branches from trees. He orders his men to do the same, and they pile the timber around the tower. And they ignite it, set the base of the tower on fire. We read that the fire consumed the tower and all those in it. Around 1,000 men and women perished in the flames. And thus Jotham's words, chapter 9, verse 15, "Let fire come out from the bramble to destroy the cedars of Lebanon." Abimelech the bramble has burned the cedars of Lebanon, the people of Shechem, thus serving fulfillment of the first part of Jotham's curse. And then we come to verse 50. Dr. Block writes, quote, "The previous episode had left the reader wondering whether Abimelech has escaped the second part of Jotham's curse." Oh no. Abimelech now moves to the city of Thebez to capture and destroy it. Thebez lay approximately 10 miles northeast of Shechem. And the scholars debate over the exact reason why Abimelech attacks this city. Most say it was due to his thirst for power and dominance to expand his kingdom. Also, as well as dealing with his own paranoia, fearing nearby cities like Shechem may attempt uprisings. So he takes out his paranoia on those in Thebez. And we read that the town fell easily into the hands of Abimelech. But like Shechem, many of them retreated into the fortresses, the strongholds, into the city walls. The people climbed to the top, the rooftop of this stronghold. Abimelech the pragmatist. Keep doing what works, in other words. What had worked in the previous altercation should work in this one as well. So he attempts to burn down this tower, these walls as well, and destroy those inside. However, just when the reader expects the tower to be ignited and collapse, the narrative takes a surprising turn when a nameless woman out of nowhere, possessing extraordinary strength, carries a millstone to the top of the roof. This millstone is literally rendered a stone of writing. That indicates it was the upper millstone. Upper millstones were normally 2 to 3 inches thick, about 18 inches in diameter, having a hole in the center. It was used for grinding corn. The task was designated for women. They had a contraption of which they set upon to scoot the stone or roll the stone over the corn, smashing it. Smashing kernels of corn, crushing them. But this time the millstone would not be used to crush corn. This woman in her desperation brought the millstone to the rooftop. perhaps intending it to be used as a weapon. She takes it to a certain point on the rooftop, and she notices, or perhaps Abimelech approaching the door of the tower. Perhaps the top of the tower was not too high for those on top to recognize those below. However, this is what we assume. Perhaps she does not know who Abimelech is, what he looks like. She simply comes to a point on the rooftop and drops it. She drops it with the intent to harm someone. The millstone drops and it hits Abimelech. Hits him on the head and crushes a portion of his skull. This is more than coincidence. For who put it in the heart of this woman to take her millstone to the rooftop? Who positioned her at a point on the rooftop to drop the stone as Abimelech approached the door at a certain time? Who controlled the dropping of the stone that it would not veer a bit to the right or to the left, that it would strike Abimelech on his skull? I ask the question, who controls the very flight of an arrow that it should find its target? Coincidence? I don't think so. By the sovereign orchestration of God, so that God would repay the evil of men. The roof is close enough. We see that those below are able or may receive word that the perpetrator of this act was a woman. And Abimelech panics as he notes that his injury is very significant, that he's soon to die. As noted in a previous story with Sisera and Jael, Jael, the woman who drove the tent peg through his temple, dishonoring him in battle, we read that in this day and age, in this culture, it was great dishonor to die at the hands of a woman. So Abimelech, realizing the significance of his injury, urged his arm bearer to grab the sword and run it through him and kill him before he dies from the hit on the head. He did not want the morning papers to read of the shame of a soldier being killed by a woman. God forbid. So he made sure that he would not have such a shameful end, and his arm bearer kills him, thus fulfilling the second part of Jotham's fable in chapter 9, verse 20. Let fire come out from you, cedars of Lebanon, citizens of Shechem, and destroy Abimelech the bramble. With that, the author records that when the Israelites saw that Abimelech was dead, they went home. We've been reading of Abimelech and the Shechemites and those of Thebez, and now all of a sudden the Israelites are back into the picture. Where did they come from? Well, we can understand that in his 3-year reign over Israel, he was able to gather loyalty and support from Israelites. They came as his loyal subjects, and his army grew. But upon his death, these loyal subjects turned and went back to their homes. Abimelech, a shameful end. God repaying the evil for what he and the Shechemites have done. A fascinating story. I've spent a lot of time just going through the story. A bit different sermon today, instead of inserting those implications and points throughout the story today, giving you the story in replay, and now coming to the most important part. It is vitally important that the reader does not forget what has taken place, as verses 56 and 57 serve as the exclamation point. Don't miss it. Thus God returned the evil of Abimelech, which he committed against his father in killing his 70 brothers. And God also made all the evil of the men of Shechem return on their heads, and upon them came the curse of Jotham, the son of Jerubbaal. Fascinating story, but the reader is not to forget, and he is to see, she is to see, that it is God who sovereignly orchestrates these events to bring about his prophetic word, his word of judgment upon wicked men. Judgment. The judgment of God, something our world does not want to hear today, but very much a part of the gospel that we need to understand. We're confronted with it over and over and over again in Judges. That He is a God of wrath. He is a God who repays the wickedness of men. So we learn some very important lessons about divine judgment here. There are many lessons we can learn about divine judgment. There's just a few here we'll look to. Verses 22 through 57 is the fulfillment of the prophetic fable God placed in the mouth of Jotham. Though he's only referenced twice in this passage, he is the most significant figure in the text. That now fire has come from Abimelech to destroy Shechem, and fire has come from Shechem to destroy Abimelech for all the treachery. And Abimelech's murdering the sons of Gideon and Shechem's support in strengthening Abimelech's hand. God has now brought down judgment. What are these significant things we learn about God's judgment from the story? The first thing we note, I found this interesting, just considering it. Perhaps you have already. We should note that sometimes there is a certain quietness about the judgment of God. What do I mean by that? If not for the references to God in verses 23 and 24, verses 56 and 57, we would perhaps not realize the significance of what's taking place. The whole episode seems to be so natural. From highway robberies to Gaal's gloating, to Zebul's intelligence work, to Abimelech's vengeance. It seems like the natural course of evil humanity. The writer describes that even the last blow to Abimelech's head in such few words, he just simply inserts, and a certain woman threw an upper millstone upon Abimelech's head. Seeming like simply a matter of course. However, what we see here, God's judgment works so gradually here. There is no smell of fire and brimstone. No fire from heaven falling to consume the city and the people. No earth cracking open and swallowing up those, like in the rebellion of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram against Moses. Just a slow, gradual destruction of sinners. If you're like me, you like basketball. How many of you used to play on those old basketball goals with backboards made of pressed sawdust or particle board? They were not highly weather resistant. The rain, the scorching sun, the hot weather, the cold weather, day after day, yeah, we left it outside. Decay began, and it went on for months. And then the bolts get loose and more so each time you play with each bank shot, until one day that final shot jars the backboard loose and it breaks apart. Sometimes God's judgment is like that. It works so silently and unobserved. But you and I, the people in our society, need to beware of thinking that God avenges only when He makes a racket. Beware of thinking that God avenges only when He makes a racket. You remember Peter's congregation, as they were mocked and proclaiming the coming judgment of God, they would cry out to the church, "Where is this judgment of God that you keep proclaiming? For the earth goes on and on." But know this, one day God's judgment will come upon us swiftly as a sudden travail comes upon a woman in childbirth. Things are rotting away continually. As we walk down the paths of rebellion, you and I may not experience immediate destruction. We even may experience some fleshly pleasures for a season. But God is taking note, and note that the withering has begun. And He will not be mocked in His wisdom, and according to His good pleasure, He brings about judgment for sin. And we see how sinful decisions, sinful practices in our life can cause our lives to slowly erode. Like a metastatic cancer, it can slowly and silently kill. And His judgment can sometimes be like this. Know this, that His judgment is just as sure as His existence. Whether it comes in fire and brimstone raining from heaven or the slow erosion as our lives slip into ruin, He brings judgment upon evil. He repays evil. God does not allow sin to go unnoticed. Our world wants to think He's the big grandfather upstairs with a sweet smile on His face and will never harm. But people are at rebellion against Him, and God has taken note, and He will not be mocked. And His judgment comes according to His good pleasure. And upon these He allows the slow decay and the slow erosion to which it comes and swallows them up in the end. We need to beware of thinking that God avenges only when He makes a racket. Know that your secrecy, your secret sins, those closet sins that you hide from everyone else, God sees. And like a cancer spreading throughout your body, it will consume you. Repent. Kill it. Mortify it. Come out from it. Live for the glory of God. Ask forgiveness and live for the righteousness of Christ. Notice another lesson God's judgment teaches us. Jotham declared, and the story reported that Abimelech destroyed Shechem, and the men of Shechem destroyed Abimelech with a little help from the city of Thebez. Here's what we see. Evil destroys evil. God frequently judges in this way, using evil men to destroy evil men. Evil nations to wipe out evil nations. Judges 9 teaches us something very important. For the Christian, for the believer, note this, there is no fellowship with evil. Evil has no lasting cohesion. It does not care for its own. It only uses its own. As we read in Revelation 17, 16 through 17, of which depicts how the Antichrist and his cronies will hate and consume the very anti-God culture they nourish. There is no true fellowship with evil. God's people should always be on alert and be reminded that there is no fellowship with evil. For what fellowship does light have with darkness? Friendship with the world is enmity with God. God has given us the provision of His Word to warn us and to have no fellowship with darkness. Do not conform to its ways. While it may pleasure you for a season, its intent is to consume you. Satan may bait the hook, whet your appetite, and appease you for a while, but his ultimate goal is to destroy you. Evil may pleasure you for a while, but the intent is to consume you, to destroy you. There's no fellowship with evil. And we are shown this through the judgment of God as evil people destroy evil people. However, the greatest lesson we learn of the passage is the greatness we learn about our God. This is what should excite us. We see His glory in His sovereignty. That He is in absolute control of the actions of men, so to accomplish His bidding. Sovereignty meaning He's in control. In control over all things. His sovereign control over events reveals these two glorious things about God. He is controlling events, revealing Himself as both judge and deliverer of His people. Notice the first reference, the evil spirit. God sent the evil spirit to disintegrate the loyalties between Shechem and Abimelech. This served to begin the downslide to bring about their destruction. As God had prophesied through Jotham, He will not be mocked. But as we established at the outset, Abimelech was first established by God as punishment for Israel. God would raise him up. Trouble from within rather than from some foreign power. You go after Baal-berith, you treat my servants with disgust. Now God brings from within their own camp a thorn to bring about hardship. So God raises up Abimelech, first establishing him as the agent of his punishment, through which he would bring punishment. They whored after Baal and acknowledged him as the God of the covenant. And God summons destruction from within, from Israel, Hebrew, to oppress Hebrews. And Abimelech served his purpose well. He brought havoc upon Israel through his actions. However, while God would use Abimelech to punish the people of the land for their sin, is it not also to be noted that God would judge Abimelech for the evil that he perpetrated? He raised up Abimelech to execute judgment and also judged Abimelech for the evil. Trying to understand all this is trying to put a square peg in a round hole. To try to finite minds, to try to understand and reconcile all of this. But what the Bible is screaming out to us is that God is most glorified. He is sovereign. He is in control. And God raises up Abimelech to bring judgment down upon the people. And people want to ask, well, is God responsible for that evil? Evil here is used by God for a higher purpose. It's used for His glory as He would bring about judgment upon their sin, and He remains absolutely distanced from that evil. He is not accountable to it. He's not responsible for it. Abimelech is responsible for his evil, but God has decreed it for His higher purposes. As He serves as judge, but also as deliverer. God would glorify Himself in raising up this judgment and deliver them from the very judgment that He raised up. People are completely responsible for the evil they commit, yet the evil they achieve is used for divine purposes. Like it or not, God is sovereign and in control, and we'll get the glory in all that happens. Abimelech carries out the judgment God has sentenced for Israel. However, here's the good news. God delivers Israel from that very judgment. Abimelech's havoc is restrained and brought to an end by God. It is restrained in that while Israel receives heartache from Abimelech's reign, others also suffer terribly but justly from his havoc. Notice that Shechem is destroyed by Abimelech's actions as he slaughters the workers in the field and burns the city to the ground, killing off all the inhabitants. What did Shechem do? They strengthened his hand to kill off the family of God's servant. But then Abimelech comes to Thebez, and note that the Lord intervenes. Abimelech has prepared the same destruction for Thebez. However, Thebez played no part in his treachery. So God spared Thebez from such disaster as the Lord would control the flight of a millstone to strike the head of Abimelech, bringing an end to his life. Just before they were burnt to the ground. And at the sight of their dead leader, Abimelech's troops retreat home. The people of the land have received due punishment for their sin, rightful recompense. And in the wisdom of God, he has destroyed Abimelech and Shechem, but he spares Thebez and the rest of the land. Those responsible for the evil against Gideon have been consumed. However, the whole land has suffered for their evil, but not to such a degree. He is the judge who decides just punishment. Judgment upon the land through Abimelech's reign has come to an end thanks to the intervention and control of God. He delivers the land from further destruction. So God serves as both judge, bringing down judgment, and deliverer from that judgment. Why am I spending so much time on this? Because we must fast forward to the gospel and see how this shows us great things about our God, even in the gospel. We see in this text God serves as both judge and deliver. When one event is God most clearly revealed as judge and deliverer, the cross of Christ. There, the wrath of God is poured out upon sin. God does not sweep sin under the rug. He does not wink at it. It must receive its rightful punishment. And upon the cross, God unleashed His wrath upon His Son to pay for the sins of the people that He would bring to Himself. So on the cross of Christ, we see clearly that God is judge, but at the same time, the cross of Christ, we see God as deliverer. As He brings down judgment, He would spare His people from His own judgment through the cross of Christ, delivering them, using the righteousness achieved by Christ as a substitutionary righteousness for those of us who are unjust. The gospel is most central. The gospel is our only hope. It is there that God glorifies Himself in revealing Himself as judge and deliverer, that He would spare people, save His people from His own wrath. You know what? It drives me crazy today to hear so much preaching teaching us that we must be saved from Satan and his minions, his cronies, and saved even from ourselves. You know what we need to be ultimately saved from? God. Because God's anger burns against us. As the Word of God tells us, it burns, it abides against us. It continually burns. And unless there is divine intervention, unless God intercedes, we remain under that wrath. And in the cross of Christ, God intercedes. As His wrath must be appeased, it must be dealt with, our sin must be accounted for, and He poured out His wrath, all of His wrath, that which will be experienced by those who are cast into hell, a place of outer darkness, a place where their worm does not die, meaning that it's a place totally void of the presence of God, a place designated for torment, a place in which His wrath will be poured out on sinners for all eternity without any possibility of mercy or escape. That's for one single solitary sin you have ever committed. One sin deserves that punishment from God. And that's what we are headed for without God's intervention. We cannot save ourselves. We cannot come out of the tomb of unbelief and sin death. We are locked in it. We have been locked in it since Adam and Eve fell. There is no escape. You can't climb out of it. You can't will your way out of it. You are dead, as Paul wrote in Ephesians 2:1, dead in trespasses and sins. You are hopelessly undone, locked in, and headed head first into hell. Unless God mercifully intervenes. And through the cross of Christ, He mercifully intervened. that all the wrath that will be poured out in hell was poured out upon His Son. We note that on the cross of Christ, He darkened the earth, would not permit man to look upon the sufferings of His Son, and Jesus would cry out, my God, why have You forsaken Me? Meaning what those will experience in hell, the abandonment of God. Jesus experienced it on the cross, and He experienced it to a degree that even those in hell would never experience, because He is the divine Son of God before He came to earth, experiencing face-to-face communion with God, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, in eternal triune fellowship. There's no greater degree of fellowship than that. Divine fellowship. He did not need to create humanity because He was the old man upstairs lonely and needed some friendship. He created us to display His glory. He didn't have to. He already had perfect communion with Himself. And Jesus, the embodiment of the Son of God, the second person of the triune God, experienced that holy, divine fellowship, face-to-face fellowship with Father and Spirit, and that was broken on the cross, and no created being could ever understand that. And Jesus experienced it on the cross. Even what those in hell would never experience in an eternity, Christ in those few moments on the cross experienced it. Why? To absorb and pay for the wrath of God intended for sinners. And so God pours out His wrath and it is appeased as Christ took it. As He lived the life that you couldn't live, a sinless life. We're born conceived in sin. We exit the womb sinners. It is an inescapable, inevitable fact. We are sinners at enmity with God, destined for hell. That's who we are. But Jesus, born of a virgin, came into this earth as the sinless one and lived 33 years on this earth sinlessly, both internally and externally. Not one impure thought, not one sinful action. So that He could go to the cross as the spotless Lamb of God, and that God would take the righteousness achieved as He pours out His wrath. Jesus takes the wrath that we deserve and gives us something that we do not deserve. That which He achieved on the cross, God takes that righteousness and imputes it on us. So that here's the point of all this. That upon the cross of Christ, God is both judge and deliverer. He judges our sin and He spares us from His wrath. We just get a glimpse of this in the story of Abimelech. That the people's depravity has reached new lows, but He will not wipe His people out. He will judge them and bring harm upon them, but to discipline them. But also, not allowing that judgment to go unrestrained, He would bring an end to it. Sparing them, delivering them from His own judgment. And we see it more fully in the cross of Christ. God is most glorified here. Both judge and deliver. The only way you will escape His wrath is through the cross of Christ. That God would open your eyes and open your hearts to embrace Christ, trust in Him, live for Him. And when you stand before God, He will not see you in your sin. He will see Christ in your place and allow you into the joy of heaven. Oh God, deliver us from our sin. Deliver us from Your inescapable judgment. One last thing I'll leave you with, a comforting thought. As God destroys Abimelech, we see that God destroys the destroyers of His people. The rulers of various ages as well as this age have never learned that whoever touches the flock of God touches the apple of His eye. Zechariah 2:8. And therefore, coming against the flock of God, He will place Himself under God's sword, under His millstone, if you will. Similarly, God's people are His sacred temple. And this is a warning to guys like me, pastors, how careful church leaders need to be that they would not teach error and harm the apple of God's eye. You are His sheep, precious in His sight. And we dare not use you for our own selfish indulgence, as I preached last week. God destroys the destroyers of His people, and this ought to make preachers tremble. So it frightens me that I would not dare manipulate and abuse His people for selfish reasons. But it also warns the people, members of the church, that you would not brew strife and contention among the flock of God, destroying, harming the flock of God. God destroys the destroyers of His people. He loves His church. Do you love the church? He loves the church so much, He came to die to give His life for it. So we treat the church of God with great love, with great affection. May God add blessing to the reading, hearing, and proclamation of His Word. Father, I pray that You have been exalted here today, glorified as Your people have been edified. We are but vessels in Your hands. We are clay in the potter's hands. You are our judge, but You are our Redeemer, our Deliverer, seen through Your Son, Jesus Christ. And Your Word teaches us that when He is exalted, You are pleased. And I pray that Jesus Christ, first and foremost, has been uplifted here today, that He has been worshipped. No man, no human agenda, but God's agenda. And the exaltation of Christ has been accomplished. And God, we are finite, fallible people. We cannot do it to the degree that You desire. That's why we need Christ and His Spirit taking our worship, conducting it, our prayers, cleaning them up, bringing them to You in the way that is a pleasing aroma to You. You desire our hearts. God, I pray that every heart here under the sound of My voice knows You, desires to exalt You, that we have been one accord here today, together, uplifting You. In Christ's name, God's people said, Amen.